Demand. The beat is on demand. The beat is on demand.
Chicago sports conversation.
Wide, wide world of sports.
Anytime, all the time. It's The Beat on demand on iTunes and WGNradio.com.
720 WGN. I'm Mark Carmen. Thrilled to be joined by one of my tennis heroes. Andre Agassi is on the line. Imagine that. Andre, going to be in Chicago coming up April the 8th at the UIC Pavilion to kick John McEnroe's ass. Is it wrong for me to say it like that, Andre? Is that too aggressive, perhaps?
No, listen, facts are facts, man. You got to stick with the, you know, stick with the truth. That's exactly what's going to happen.
Are you enjoying the senior circuit workouts? How's that going for you?
You know, I'm enjoying this particular platform. I've always looked for ways to stay involved with the game. It's been such an institutional piece of my life. But with that being said, it's kind of hard balanced with everything else. But this platform really allows me to get out there, you know, both from a time schedule, logistics schedule, but also a physical schedule. You know, you get these four guys that come in, and you get to go hard. You get to be there for an evening, and you get a chance to recover, which is the hardest part as you get older, as you may or may not have learned yet. So I really like the connection that I can have with my peers, as well as the environment of entertainment it provides. It's done in a very realistic way that we can break away from our families and our lives and keep ourselves active and have some fun and take it in stride.
And sadly, I have learned that, 42 years old, Andre, trying to move from the 4-0 to the 4-5 level, but I don't think the listeners actually want to hear me talk about tennis, although really all I want to do with this is like try to figure out how to make my forehand better, but maybe another time. You, on the other hand, had a pretty good forehand, 8-time Grand Slam champion, return of serve, backhand serve. I don't want to slight any other part of your game as well, but I'm wondering, when you're looking back on it, or if you do that at all, because you also were in 7 other Grand Slam finals. Do you ever sit back and think, man, I should have had that one or this one or that? Is that like, hey, I'm about moving forward. I don't really think about my career that way.
No, I mean, I think it's easy to have regrets, but I think I was really comfortable that the regrets wouldn't take too much of my future the day I won Paris. You know, that would have been the biggest regret of them all, the last of the four Grand Slams, the one I sort of, I think people felt I should have won. I know I did 10 years earlier as my first one, could have won, favored in 2 finals, and then to have sort of one that just kind of eludes you, it's a, you know, that would have been a hard one. But when I won there, I mean, quite frankly, more is just more. I mean, all those stats sound great until you compare it to my wife, and when I watch how she carries on with her life, it's about how you choose to live today that's most relevant. So I really don't think about how many I could have won. I didn't play 10 Australian Opens. You know, Borg only played 1 Australian Open. So this day and age, they definitely judge your career on numbers. I think that's more overrated than taking into some intangible accounts of accomplishment. And I'm not putting myself in that discussion at all. I don't even mean it to come across that way. I'm just saying, you know, it's easy to say numbers matter, but what the truth is, how you go about your work, maximizing what you could have got out of yourself. You know, I had plenty of those moments where I'm proud.
Well, and listen, you're the last American to win the French, and you're the last American to win all 4. I mean, you had an amazing, incredible career. I guess one of the things that fascinates me about your career is that, you know, you go pro, you're 16 years old, and then, you know, your career goes sideways, and then you're all of a sudden this different guy. You get rid of the hair, you're bald, and you're better than ever. I mean, I guess I'm curious, like, when you look back on it, how did that transformation in your mind, like, how did that crystallize if you were to really boil it down?
I would probably say to you that while I seemed successful in the first half of my career, I truly wasn't, because I was really disconnected with my life. Tennis was never my choice. And it wasn't until I found my reason that I sort of went to a new place and a new way of approaching what I did, from an emotional perspective, from a physical perspective. So at 1 in the world, at sitting there at number 1 in the world and sort of hating your life, that's quite a quite a telling point, and that's what started a real spiral for 2 years. But my recovery from it was recognizing that just because I didn't choose my life doesn't mean I can't take ownership of it. And in taking ownership of it, I needed to find my reason finally for playing. I didn't want it to be no longer my dad, you know, for a period of my life, no longer, you know, the pressures of just success and not having anything to do. You know, fear is a hell of a motivator, but I wanted to really be proactive in taking that ownership, and that's when I started to think about the school and inspire about giving children a choice that otherwise society has written off, because the alternative to them having choice is not being number one in the world. It's them waking up in gangs or in our prison systems, and that to me has been my fuel, my inspiration. So the second half of my career, quite frankly, I just got out of my own way by making it about something else. And when that happened, I felt more connected at 140 in the world after being number one in the world than I did the first time at number one. But the second time at number one, I got to say, the thing that surprised me most about it was really no different than being 140, because every day you had to figure out ways to get better. Because first of all, at 140, you don't know if you'll ever get back. You don't think you can, but you still know you can be better than you are today. And then at number one in the world, you have nobody else to compare yourself to. So as a result of that, you have to figure out how to focus on the things you can control. And you can control, you know, your training. You can control your commitment. You can control, you know, your desires. And so I just always had to find ways. So it was very strange to realize that number one in the world, 141 in the world, you know, doing your work right, it looks the same.
Andre Agassi, and he's raised over $60 million through your charitable foundation for at-risk kids, which is
175.
175.
Don't cheat me. You got old stats going, man. It's been two decades, for God's sake.
$175 million. I mean, do you know how much? That's incredible. I mean, really, congratulations. And, you know, if you haven't read Andre's book, Open, it's a phenomenal read. It's a must read. And it's really how much you've shared is just phenomenal. And it can be great help really to anyone in whatever you're trying to succeed in. I'm curious, like on the tennis court, you know, there's so much pressure and so much going around, and people feel that in whatever part in their lives. Like, how did you, I guess, present yourself where you got the drama from out of your head where it was elsewhere and you were just there and able just to play?
Yeah, it's a muscle that you have to develop, you know, no doubt. I think the hardest part is the energy that we all spend worrying about stuff that really we have no say over. That is a very useless, inefficient way to go about any goal or objective. You know, in tennis there was a scoreboard, and that scoreboard was a reflection of 1,000 decisions. You know, and you have to make sure that each decision you're making on a daily basis is incrementally making you, you know, better, because that preparation is something that you'll see the separation from those that aren't doing it. So I think generally speaking, it's hard for somebody to get away from results and get back to application, because it's easy to overlook the momentum you can actually build for yourself if you stick to it. It's why diet plans don't work, right? I mean, everybody says, okay, I'm going to do it. They go very extreme, and then it falls by the wayside. But if you can somehow just implement something and make it the fabric of how you're going to choose to go about living your life, it does build some serious momentum. And I fortunately was blessed enough to survive long enough out there to get my arms around that reality, and that helps me sleep at night these days.
It's an enormous challenge, right? Okay, so for the tennis diehards out there who want to help their son or daughter become a tennis player, and you obviously had a very intense upbringing around it, what's your advice to parents? I mean, when you and Steffi are talking about this, I'm sure people ask you all the time. What do you tell people who want to at least guide their kid aggressively into the sport but, like, don't obviously want to go too far?
Yeah, well, I would say, here's what I would say. The most important decision you'll ever make as a parent is really the first one, which is how you're going to define success for your child and how you're going to define success for yourself as a parent. And if you define success wrong, you are truly on a trajectory that will never be able to walk that that balancing act. You'll never be able to to hold that tension because your goals and objectives are not in your control. There's nothing for a person to do that's going to make somebody succeed or make somebody not succeed. But what you can do is teach somebody how to be a successful person, you know, and that boils down to work ethics, and that boils down, you know, to obviously, you know, giving the opportunities, but also teaching your child to look at every intersection of their life as an opportunity. You know, it's, I see so many kids now, especially through my children's activities and passions. I see so many kids out there that really lack an emotional context, which is normal in sorts. But what is unmistakably apparent is those kids that have that healthy balance from their home environment that allow them to know that they have a place in this world regardless. You know, that those are the kids that really seem to shine and to improve at a much faster rate given any opportunity. So it really, it's a loss for a parent to focus on something that they can't control, whether it's being rich, being winning a Grand Slam, being the best athlete in the world, and it's a loss for the child and developing across the board so that they're prepared for whatever road they end up traveling.
You think, just one more on that if it's handled correctly, it does put the kid at an advantage having that experience at a young age?
Absolutely. I mean, you can never. The outlier in that is truly that fear is one hell of a motivator, and unfortunately, there's a lot of kids that live with fear, whether it's in one form or another. Whether it's, well, what am I going to do if I don't? I cannot not succeed. And I've seen kids like that, me being one of them, that had a level of discipline, but also a level of instability and disconnect, quite frankly. And I think I got more lucky than I did good. But you also see other kids, and I would imagine, I know Federer as an example to some degree, and here's a guy, or even Novak Djokovic, here's a guy that would sweep the courts from shrapnel of sleeping bomb shelters and wake up in the morning and, in the light of day and have to clean up the court to go practice. You're talking about a person that's not going to lose perspective, that's going to be thankful for, so many things that, so many of us can take for granted. And then I think there's a healthier way to go about it, and I think those are two examples of guys that are showing that maturity and balance.
The great Andre Agassi with us here on 720 WGN. Just two more for you. Number one, do you and Steffi get on the court, and if so, who wins? Let's go there.
We don't too much, quite frankly. Sometimes she wants exercise, and I want to feel the only thing I did well, which is ball strike. So we make a very strong agreement to one another that I will run her around if she hits the ball back to me, and so I like that. I like that balance. It keeps me from having to work too hard, and I get to watch her, like poetry in motion. And then, as far as who wins, I would say, unfortunately, the most important lesson that you learn in tennis that you never learn is the first one. It's the last one. Is to watch the ball, and that gets a little bit more difficult for me when I play against her.
That's that's awesome. Okay, April 8th, UIC Pavilion. Andre will be there with John McEnroe and Jim Courier and James Blake, and I've seen you guys play in this event before. It's a ton of fun, and it's great tennis, so you should come on out. Last one, your favorite rival when go back to your playing career, is it Pete, or would you say someone else?
Well, favorite is a kind of it's hard for me to understand that exact definition of that, because what does it really mean? I mean, I feel like Pete made me, while he ripped away many many trophies and accomplishments, he also made me a better player, and he also made me more of an aware athlete, and he also inspired me to keep searching for a connection with my sport, so that I could go about it the way really he does, which at times appeared even disconnected with emotion. And that's what you have to do when you're out there. You have to, there's a job, and you got to put your emotions aside in order to do that job most effectively. So Pete, no doubt, sort of stands alone in that respect. But I, quite frankly, I love playing Rafter. Rafter was a guy that had a totally different game than me. but he was just such a player. It's like when I lost to Rafter, I felt like, well, at least Rafter won. I mean, he was that kind of guy, and he gave you a rhythm, which is one of Pete's great strengths, is his ability to not give you rhythm. So it always seemed like we both played at quite a high level every time we stepped on the court, and so those two guys are kind of top of the list for me.
That's awesome. And then today's game, do you see Novak going down as the greatest ever if he continues on his path?
Well, if he continues on his path, I don't think anybody's going to be doubting that. I mean, the guy doesn't lose anymore, so it's remarkable to watch him play. You know, you have to look at this generation, first of all, and I'll consider Djokovic, Federer, and Nadal the same generation, even though maybe you could argue, you know, the nuance of their primes. You know, it's the greatest generation, in my opinion, in the history of our game. Remarkable to see how many times each of them have beat the other one, and every time they have, it's usually been with everything on the line. Fed has 17. Again, if we're using numbers as a barometer, still a significant way to go for Djokovic, but I've never considered numbers to be the defining component. You know, we've watched Nadal as a teenager beat Fed. We've watched him, you know, have a considerable head-to-head over him, and we've watched him do other things. So, you know, can you really say who's better, who's not? I don't think it's you can say it. And for Djokovic to go on and win Paris, which I think he'll have to do at some point in order to really, be considered to kind of in that discussion, you got to be able to get over the hump, you know, in all those arenas, which I was so proud to present Fed with a trophy at Paris the year that he finally won, you know. And so if he goes on and wins Paris, I mean, even if he isn't close to 17, I think you still got to look at it as a discussion. As a sports fan, you got to look at that as a discussion that's worth having.
Which was your favorite to play?
Every athlete likes playing where they have most success. It's just unfortunately you can't separate the two. So I love New York for a lot of reasons, but if you told me I get to go play, you know, Australian or New York, Australian was just way more suited to my ability to succeed out there. But, you know, then you got this other thing happening during these grand slams called life, you know, and life is pretty darn special in London. It's pretty darn special in Paris. It's pretty darn special in New York. But shoot, I'll take winning it. And if that's the case, I gotta go with Down Under.
Andre, really appreciated the conversation. Congrats on all the success you're having off the court after your playing career, raising $175 million through your charity. I mean, that's just unbelievable. And really the message you're sending, and I think it's motivating to a ton of people. We're looking forward to seeing you in Chicago in less than a month, or actually it's a little bit over than a month. I guess I'm getting lost on my dates. April the 8th, everybody, at the UIC Pavilion. Come on out. Thanks so much for the time, Andre.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing you.
This has been The Beat on Demand. Listen to The Beat on the air Saturdays and Sundays at 3 p.m. on 720 WGN.